afternoon, everyone. My name is Susan Galnis. I'm the courtroom deputy for this session today. Our panel today is Judge Canby, Judge Clifton, and Judge Friedland presiding. We have with us, arguing for the federal appellants, August Flengy, special counsel to the United States Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Flengy, are you on the call?
I'm here, thank you.
And for the state appellee plaintiffs, we have Noah Purcell, the Solicitor General from the Office of the Washington State Attorney General, appearing from Washington. Mr. Purcell, are you here with us on the call?
I am, yeah.
Thank you both. Counsel for each side will have a total of 30 minutes, including any time that the appellant's counsel wishes to reserve for rebuttal. Counsel is responsible for keeping track of their own time, especially because they can't see the clock. I can see the clock, and the judges can see the clock, so we'll try to help you, but you need to track your time as well. When you speak, attorneys, please state your name before you speak, as well as when you get back up for rebuttal. And also, please listen very carefully for questions coming from the panel, as you won't be able to see them indicating intention, so they will have to interrupt you. So listen for that. A reminder to everyone, we are streaming this argument live through our website. It's also streaming live on various news outlets. We will post a recording of the audio as soon as we can after the session on our website. What you will see on the screen, if you're looking at a screen while you're listening to this, is you'll see who is the name of who is speaking. So we will try to keep up with that, both with respect to the attorneys who are arguing as well as when our judges are speaking. Call the session to order, and counsel, please wait for the presiding judge to open the session before you actually begin. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session.
Good afternoon. The case on our emergency motion docket today is State of Washington et al. Versus Donald J. Trump et al., case number 17-35105. This is Judge Friedland presiding by telephone. Judges Canby and Clifton are also on the line. We thank you, counsel, for your very helpful briefing and for appearing today on short notice. As you have heard, you'll each have 30 minutes. And I will try to help you with your time because I know you can't see a timer like you would in the courtroom. But if you could also please try to watch the time yourselves, that would be great. With that, we will hear first from the government. Mr. Flengy, please proceed.
May it please the court. I'm August Flengy with the Justice Department here on behalf of the United States. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The executive order at issue puts a temporary pause on entry for individuals from seven countries that Congress and the last president determined, in a similar context, pose special risks in terms of terrorist infiltration into our country. Those determinations were made in 2015 and 2016, based either on a congressional determination or statutory factors, including their foreign terrorist organizations had significant presence in the country, or the country served as a safe haven for terrorists. The order also temporarily halted the refugee program. This judgment was well within the president's power as delegated to him by Congress, and it is constitutional, as the court in Boston in Hilal Kalam recently held. Under Section 212F, Congress has expressly authorized the president to suspend entry of classes of aliens when it is necessary or when otherwise it would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. That's what the president did here. And the president's determination that a 90-day pause was needed for the seven countries at issue here in order to ensure adequate standards, and that's language from the order, for visa screening was plainly constitutional. The district court's order, which contained no assessment of the legality of the order, was in error, and we encourage the court to stay. A key factor in the order and its temporary nature was the president's determination that there was a need to review existing practices for screening foreign nationals who apply for visas.
The order recommends, if I can interrupt for a moment, you're asking for a stay of the temporary order of the district court. No matter which way we rule on the stay, presumably that appeal of the order remains in place. Is that correct? Or are you trying? Sometimes I get the impression from the papers that we're trying to argue the merits of the appeal itself rather than the merits of the stay.
Yes, Your Honor. There is some overlap, but yes, we are at this point just asking for a stay pending review by this court. Of course, the standards are pretty similar since both would look at the traditional injunction standards. With respect to those standards, I do want to say there are two kind of significant irreparable injuries that we are citing in support of our request for a stay. The first irreparable injury has to do with the assessment of risk that the president made in balancing our interest in welcoming people into this country with our interest in making sure our procedures are secure so that the risk of terrorism is acceptable. The president struck that balance, and the district court's order has upset that balance. This is a traditional national security judgment that is assigned to the political branches and the president, and the court's order immediately altered that.
Have you offered any evidence to support this need that you're describing for the executive order, or are you really arguing that we can't even ask about whether there's evidence because this decision is not reviewable?
Sure. The order itself includes findings. Those findings recognize the crucial role that screening presents in the visa process. They recognize that numerous foreign-born individuals have been convicted or implicated in crimes since October 11th. It recognizes that deteriorating conditions in certain countries create further problems. So the order created a pause so that the screening process could immediately be reviewed to ensure it's adequate.
Has the government pointed to any evidence connecting these countries with terrorism?
These proceedings have been moving very fast. The strongest point on that is that in 2015 and 2016, both Congress and the administration made determinations that these seven countries posed the greatest risk of terrorism, and in doing so, restricted visa waiver to people who had even traveled to those countries over the last 5 or 6 years. The executive order relies on that determination, and that is, I think, the strongest type of reliance where the president is relying on Congress's determination that these are countries of concern and Congress's procedures to identify countries of concern based on significant terrorist activity in the countries.
This is Judge Clifton. I understand the concept of that, but it's pretty abstract. And it's not like there haven't been processes in place to take some care with people coming from those countries. Indeed, those are the determinations in the statute by the prior administration you're pointing to. Is there any reason for us to think that there's a real risk or that circumstances have changed so that there would be a real risk if existing procedures weren't allowed to stay in place while the new administration conducts its review?
Well, the president determined that there was a real risk. That's why the president determined that the best course was a temporary, it's short halt, in entry for 90 days while these procedures are looked at. And that's understandable. The president comes into office with an obligation to protect the national security of our country. The president understands, and it explains in the order, that these visa screening procedures are crucial. And the president understands that Congress identified these seven countries, as well as in 2016, the president.
In naming those seven countries, what Congress did was to provide that people coming from those countries had to get visas. In other words, they couldn't just come into the country without a visa. And that permitted, of course, the usual investigations before you give somebody a visa. In a transcript of the hearing in the district court, asks the representative of the Department of Justice, you're in the Department of Justice, how many federal offenses have we had being committed by people who came in with visas from these countries? And the answer was there haven't been any.
Yes, Your Honor. These proceedings have been moving quite fast, and we're doing the best we can.
Things are moving fast, but you appealed to us before you continued in the district court to develop the record. So why should we be hearing this now if it sounds like you're trying to say you're going to present other evidence later?
Well, I was just about to at least mention a few examples. There have been a number of people from Somalia connected to Al-Shabaab who have been convicted in the United States.
Is that in the record? Can you point us to where in the record you're referring?
It is not in the record. There is also in other examples, but again, you're correct. These are not in the record. The reason we sought immediate relief and a stay is because of the district court's decision overrides the president's national security judgment about the level of risk, and we've been talking about the level of risk that is acceptable. As soon as we're having that discussion, it should be acknowledged that the president is the official that is charged with making those judgments. I'd also like to
are you arguing then that the president's decision in that regard is unreviewable?
There are obviously constitutional limitations, but we're discussing the risk assessment.
What are the constitutional limitations that the government acknowledges?
I would more say that the plaintiff has asserted various constitutional limitations. And I think the case that is most on point as far as constitutional interests are Mandel and Dinn. And in those cases where you have a U.S. citizen raising a claim, the court looks only at the U.S. citizen's constitutional claim, and even then looks at whether the decision is facially legitimate and bona fide. The executive order here meets that standard easily. It relies on...
In both of those cases, though, there's specific statutes by Congress that set forth specific criteria that apply factually were at issue. The president is not applying any specific criteria from Congress here, is he?
Yes, the president is. The president is applying Section 212F, which authorizes the president to suspend entry of classes of aliens if their entry would be, quote, detrimental to the interests of the United States. The Supreme Court recognized that Congress and the president share the act of exclusion of aliens as a fundamental act of sovereignty that the Congress and the president are within the powers of Congress and the president. So our point would be that there's limited review and the executive order, and most limited review in the executive order, easily passes that test. And that would only be true if there's a...
What kind of limited review do you acknowledge is appropriate?
Again, we're not acknowledging any review on the facts of this case because of a lot of standing and other problems with the state bringing the claim. What we acknowledge is that Mandel conducted a limited review to see that the decision was bona fide and legitimate.
Haven't there been allegations here of bad faith? Doesn't Mandel and Din, the concurrence of Din, envision that that's something that we would need to look at?
When reviewing executive order of the president under Section 212F, the review should be confined to the four corners of the document to determine if the document, if the decision itself and the executive order's findings have any issues with respect to the standard. And again, I'm sort of far ahead of our position. This would be if there is a party in the U.S. with standing to raise their own constitutional claims, and there are problems at each step of that analysis. The state of Washington doesn't have these kind of constitutional interests. There are the state of Washington can't bring a parent's patriae suit on behalf of its citizens in this context. And
why even start? Let me interrupt you for a second here. There are some talk in the Supreme Court cases of quasi-sovereign interests. And, for instance, a state might have an interest in clean air. And when it sues to protect its air, it's necessarily acting for its citizens. The state itself can't smell air, it can't see air. It has to be acting on behalf of its citizens. When it brings a case like that, yet there seems to be authority for the state to bring that kind of a claim.
Well, the problem in the immigration context, and actually more generally, is a third party can't challenge visa denials or revocations. The claims that the state is bringing are essential.
The whole point of the Din case was that Din himself, or rather Din's husband, couldn't challenge, but she could. And three justices of the court were prepared to throw it out at the first step, but the other six justices were not. They took up the claim. Why is the state of Washington in a comparable position, say, as the proprietor of the state universities, having the same kind of interest that the scholar plaintiffs did in Mandel?
Well, the problem is because the state's asserting a parents patriae theory where...
they're also asserting their own interests as proprietors of the university and otherwise tax revenues?
Yes. But let me finish with the first theory and then I'll get to that. The parents patriae theory assumes you're asserting the rights on behalf of the beneficiary, but... there's well-established law that in the immigration context, the sort of third-party interest and the case O'Bannon describes this is not something that can be asserted. I
suggest that Perry versus Dan asserts exactly that. I mean, in Perry versus Dan, the plaintiff, Dan, was the wife of the person who was excluded. So the person who was excluded may not have had any rights that he could assert directly, but his wife was allowed to.
And the state, I mean, the state doesn't have the sort of constitutional rights that the wife and Din had. The wife and Din made her right. Own.
But why is the state's right the same as the scholars in Mandel? And Mandel was a foreigner. He might not have had rights, but the court took the case up because people who argued they wanted to be able to hear him, the various universities to which he'd been invited. Well, University of Washington, Washington State invite people. Why doesn't the state of Washington have the same standing that the scholars did in Mandel?
Again, you have to look on behalf of the people that it wants, it's bringing suit on behalf of. It's sort of collapsing the inquiry.
I understand you're moving away, or I'm dragging you away from the parents contrary theory. Speaking for myself, I agree with you on that. The state can't do that. But the state is also asserting a proprietary interest, in particular as the owner and operator of the universities. And it seems to me they line up very much as the way the plaintiffs in Mandel did.
Well, on that point, our claim is that it doesn't have a judicially cognizable or legally protected interest in third-party immigration benefits.
The same case that was raised in Curry versus Dent, and the majority of the court didn't say that. That was an immigration case. Mandel was an immigration case, both involving visa denials. And yet,
they have to come up. Sure. They have to talk about what the constitutional interest of the state entity is. And it's well established that there's no due process.
Why is it limited to the state entry? In Dinn, she wasn't asserting her own rights. She was asserting her husband's rights. In Mandel,
she was asserting her. Sorry,
it was her right as the wife, claiming the loss of consortium and so forth. But the visa denial was to her husband. In this case, the state of Washington is claiming that it's going to hurt the university if it's not able to have these people come to the university. That sounds very much like the same kind of right that was asserted in Mandel.
Well, hurting the university isn't enough now that we've turned on to the actual challenge. The state has to assert, the state has to have a constitutional interest, because in Dinn, it was the constitutional interest of the U.S. citizen spouse that the court was looking at. And if you
look at the constitutional interest in Pierce versus Society of Sisters, where the school was allowed to assert the rights of the students and their families.
That was a case where, if I remember correctly, the university was acting on behalf of challenging a state law where that affected its students. There you would have constitutional interests for the students at the school. Here, aliens would not. I do want to turn to a very...
Isn't that the merits question? So why can't we reach the merits question through the third-party standing asserted by the universities and the states here? The universities are part of the states.
Well, I think I'll just tie it together a little bit because of the well-established authority that the state entity can't assert these kind of rights. And even on the merits, I would like to point out that the executive order relied on the congressional and administrative determination of years ago of 2015 and 2016. So it's not an order that discriminates in a way on the basis of religion, and there would not be a valid equal protection. Before I run out of time, go ahead.
I heard the president simply say in the order, we're not going to let any Muslims in.
That's not what the order does here.
I know.
The order relies on. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Could he do that?
That's not what the order does here. I do want to get to one key point.
Well, we'd like to get to an answer to that question. Because it speaks back to the standing issue. If the order said Muslims cannot be admitted, would anybody have standing to challenge that?
I think Mandel and Dinn give a route to make a constitutional challenge if there were such an order. It would be by a U.S. citizen with a connection to someone seeking entry. This is a far cry from that situation.
Is there a purpose in standing doctrine? I mean, standing is supposed to ensure adversity. Is there any purpose for your argument that we shouldn't recognize this lawsuit by the states and we should instead wait for an individual to bring the same claims? What's the purpose of that?
Well, there needs to be a concrete, legally protected interest that's judicially cognizable. And across the country, there are many lawsuits where there is clearly is standing. There are people impacted by this order, and there are cases across the country where we don't have these types of standing arguments. But in this case, there's a lot of law that says states can't step into the shoes of their citizens in this context. We have the sort of proprietary interests are very diffuse, and if we credit them, there would be almost no limitations on standing. I think in that context, it doesn't make sense to extend standing jurisprudence to cover this kind of situation. But I'm not sure I'm convincing the court, so I want to make one really key point with regard to the injunction, and that is that it is overbroad and should be immediately stayed to the extent it is overbroad, even if the court thinks some applications of the order are problematic. The state has admitted that people abroad without U.S. prior U.S. contacts do not have rights that can be asserted by them, and we agree. In the district court, the state said our claim is primarily focused on the people who are here or who have been here and left. And on appeal, the state went further, explaining, quote, this case, by contrast to cases on entry, involves long-time residents who are here and have constitutional rights, end quote. That is the nature of the state's claim. The injunction goes far beyond that.
The states are claiming that this executive order violates the Establishment Clause. If that's true, and it can't meet the standards that the Establishment Clause would impose, then wouldn't it be invalid on its face?
Your Honor, the state has said that their case, quote, involves long-time residents who are here and have constitutional rights, end quote. That is from their brief at page 10.
If someone has rights for Establishment Clause rights, then can't an Establishment Clause claim be made by one individual and invalidate the whole thing? I'm not sure why that's responsive.
The scope of the injunction, whether it's nationwide or anything else, should be limited to the scope of what the state itself says it is kind of representing through its various theories of standing. But issuing a broader injunction violates the principle that an injunction should only be as extensive as is necessary to fully remedy the claims of the parties.
Declarations indicate that the state universities invite foreign scholars to come to the state, make presentations, come for time, go back, and that they want to continue doing that, which means that there will be future invitations to scholars who do not yet have a connection with this community.
I believe there are some declarations along those lines, but I am describing the actual statement of the extent of their suit that they made in the brief to this court. And to the extent that is the relief they seek, this court should immediately stay the relief that extends broader, and that is to people who have never been to the United States. And Section 5 of the order, which is the refugee provision and applies to people who haven't been here yet and don't have those relations with the university and don't quote involve long-time residents who are here and have constitutional rights. I'm into my rebuttal time, but I would strongly encourage the court, even if it has concerns with the government's position, that it immediately stay the portion of the injunction that applies outside the boundaries of the U.S. And extends beyond people who have been in, who are in the U.S. or who have been in the U.S. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Purcell?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Washington State Solicitor General Noah Purcell on behalf of the states of Washington and Minnesota. Your Honor, it has always been the judicial branch's role to say what the law is and to serve as a check on abuses by the executive branch. That judicial role has never been more important defendants have pursued the wrong remedy by seeking a stay in this court rather than mandamus. Of course, the defendants have no notice of appeal and then a motion for stay.
If this is close to, why should we care?
Well,
your position, the district court, suppose the district court issued an order requiring all the public schools in the state of Washington to be closed because of some concern about a flu epidemic, and did it in the form of a TRO, and said the TRO would only last less than 14 days. Are you suggesting mandamus is the only form of relief available? You're basically saying we shouldn't look at it. It's hard for me to envision an order this sweeping that shouldn't be subject to some kind of appellate oversight. You've got a TRO that by its terms, we've now received the proposed schedule and the district court has entered an order, so we know already that this TRO is going to stay in place for more than the 14 days contemplated by Rule 65. So why shouldn't we view this as an injunction?
Well, first of all, in the cases where this court has treated a TRO as an injunction, that timeline of the order was vastly longer. In the SEIU case, the order lasted 4 months. Here, the order will be fully, the district court supposedly called the order a temporary restraining order. Ordered a very quick order the parties to confer and agree on a briefing schedule, and briefing will be complete within 14 days of the entry of the order. It could be completed faster if the government hadn't filed this appeal. And of course, this has been quite too much time on that.
Today as you want, but I suggest this might not be the topic that's most important.
The only point I make is that mandamus does allow review. It's just an extremely strict standard. And the important point also is that if the court treats this as an appealable order, then that's what the ultimate appeal of the ultimate ruling will be of. Whereas if the court properly treats this as a mandamus decision and sends it back to the district court, the district court will have an opportunity to enter a more full preliminary injunction when the district court understands that that's what it's doing, when that's its intent. And that will be what the court can ultimately review, as opposed to reviewing what the court clearly intended to be a temporary restraining order.
Yes, Judge Kennedy, in your view, if we left this order in place, would there be a preliminary injunction hearing in the district court?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. The parties have agreed to a briefing schedule. The preliminary injunction motion will be fully briefed by a week from Friday. We'll schedule a hearing quickly after that. The 14-day limit is for ex parte temporary restraining orders by this one. Part of the problem with treating this as a temporary restraining order, Your Honor, is that if the defendants are right that any time the court enters a temporary restraining order after a hearing and receiving a briefing, it's treated as a preliminary injunction, that's a terrible rule to create for district courts. Because it discourages them from hearing from the other side before entering a temporary restraining order. But I do sort of want to move on to the merits. I don't want to spend all your time on this. And of course, if this is treated as a motion for stay, we obviously still believe that the court should reject that motion. And the most simple basis for that, of course, would be the lack of irreparable harm. I heard Governors begin pressing counsel for a statement of what irreparable harm is, and still no clear factual claims or evidentiary claims of what that irreparable harm would be from a state. And in fact, it was the executive order itself that caused irreparable harm to our states, to Washington and Minnesota, and our residents, and to many other states and people, as described in the many amicus briefs that have been filed. Of course, we believe that the federal government has shown no irreparable harm from reinstating the status quo prior to the executive order.
What's the irreparable harm to the state of Washington?
From the executive order? Well, we detailed a number of irreparable harms, Your Honor. We had students and faculty at our state universities who were stranded overseas. We had families that were separated. We had long-term residents who could not travel overseas to visit their families without knowing that they would be able to come back. We had lost tax revenue.
I don't agree with your parents' patriae theory, then in balancing the harms and thinking about the standards for a stay or for a TRO, are we limited to looking at the proprietary interests of the state itself, or can we look beyond that, even if we reject the parents' patriae theory, or do we need the parents' patriae theory to expand the harms that we can consider?
I don't think the parents' patriae theory is essentially that we've argued two independent grounds for standing, one the proprietary harms that we're suffering, and one the parents' patriae.
So say we agree with the proprietary theory for standing. Does that have any implications for what we can then consider when considering the factors for a TRO and for a stay? Or is it just a way to get standing and then we can consider anything in the public interest that affects the public interest?
I think we're primarily just going to stand in, Your Honor, because I think the harms, maybe you would not consider the harms, the other harms in the balancing of activities and the public interest factor of the test, I suppose, as opposed to in the standing test, but certainly those harms would not become irrelevant. It's not at this point, it's really the federal government that's asking the court to upset the status quo. Things have slowly gone, are returning to normal to the situation before the chaos of the executive order. And it's the federal government that's asking the court to upend that status quo again. And, Your Honor, I think it's very careful for the government repeatedly sort of to limit the nature of our claim by quoting from our brief, and I think that misrepresents our claim to some extent in a way that's important, because the claim we're making in the brief there about long-term residence is that this case is different from Mandel and Dinn in an important way, in that the federal actions here affect long-term residents who have been here, and that's not all it affects. It also affects people who are trying to visit them, it affects those people trying to visit their families. The establishment clause violation affects everyone in a sense, and once as the court knows, the case law is quite clear that establishment clause violations on their own show irreparable injury. And we, of course, believe that claim is very strong. So, just on the merits, the state has shown a strong likelihood of success. The federal government has shown a strong likelihood of success. And the federal government certainly hasn't met its burden on review of showing a likelihood of overcoming
as far as the establishment clause claim goes, the government takes a position, I think, that in weighing the validity of your establishment clause claim, you're confined to the four corners of the instrument. What's your comment on that?
I think the case law shows that that's wrong. I think it was Judge Clifton who pointed out, Judge Friedland, I'm sorry, or maybe both, Kerry versus Dinn says exactly the opposite. This court's decision in Cardenas says exactly the opposite, that if the plaintiff makes plausible allegations sufficiently supported of bad faith, the court can look behind the motive. And in those cases, just to be clear, those are cases where the case had to do with excluding an alien who had never been here and had no right to be here. So if anything, the court should take a harder look at the real motive in a case where there are significant impacts on people who do live here, who've been here for many years, who are long-term residents and who clearly have entitled themselves to constitutional rights of due process and equal protection, unlike in Kerry and Mandel, where it really was the rights being harmed were the people overseas. It was the people here who were asserting them.
So the assertion that the court took up the claim only because the case of Kerry versus Dinn, Ms. Dinn was a U.S. citizen. Of the number of people affected by the executive order, do you have any information as to what proportion would fit within the category of Washington residents or
lawful order,
people with visas? I suspect it's a small fraction.
I think two things from that, Your Honor. First of all, we are at the pleading stage. We have not had an opportunity. We filed a complaint and a motion for temporary restraining order, way the order was originally interpreted. Excuse me, Your Honor. Defendants originally interpreted the order and said that it covered lawful permanent residents. We know that there are roughly 500,000 lawful permanent residents from these seven countries in the United States. Now, they changed their mind about 5 times about whether it applies to those people in the order issued, and now they say that it doesn't. But at the time the state filed its complaint, that had not yet made their position clear about that, and I would say that argument is not moved yet because under the voluntary cessation standard, until they change the order to make that crystal clear, they can't just say, well, now we say it doesn't apply to them, so don't worry about it. I mean, that's 5 million people who are in the United States who overnight, at least according to the government initially, lost their right to travel, to come in and out of the country, to visit their relatives. And so people
will say, why should we limit the order, the temporary restraining order, reach to those people you've got a strong case for, like the LPRs? Why should the temporary restraining order reach beyond that? That seemed to be the government's principal argument, that it was overbroad. Why isn't it overbroad?
For three key reasons, Your Honor. First of all, limiting the order in that way would not address all the harms the order is causing. So, for example, it would not remedy the order's violation of the establishment clause, which harms everyone in our states, as well as our states themselves, by favoring one religious group over another. It also would not fully remedy the order's violation of the Equal Protection Clause because the order relies on discriminatory animus to deny some of our residents who are here the ability to receive visits from their friends and family while allowing others to receive those visits. And so on, so it wouldn't address all the harms. The second point is that our U.S. as in Dan, the U.S. citizens who are here who are related to these folks overseas do have rights. And it would not address their rights at all to limit it that way. And then finally, Your Honor, I just say that defendants have not explained how they would workably implement the narrow order that they're now proposing, which they didn't really propose in any way before. Their approach would require some sort of system for quickly approving travel and reentry by thousands of people from the affected countries who live here, who study here, who work here in our businesses, and who often have to travel for work or to visit family. And they just have not probably described how they would be able to do that, even if it were able to address all of our harms.
In evaluating your Establishment Clause claim, should we apply Larson or Lennon?
Your Honor, we think we prevail under either test, but we think this case is closer to Larson because in Larson, what you had was a facially neutral law. It did not mention any religious denomination by name, but it did focus on religious groups. And the result of it was to distinguish between them in a way that favored some and not others. And that's exactly what we have here. We have an order that on its face doesn't mention any denomination, but that we have alleged, and there's three evidence already to support, is intended to favor some religious groups over others. And that is exactly the situation in Larson. I know the other side is saying if it doesn't mention a particular denomination on the face of the document, then Larson doesn't apply, but that's not what Larson itself says. In Larson, the law did not mention a denomination. But again, we also think that we prevail under the Lemon test, which is explained in some detail in our district court briefing. We do not, unfortunately, have space really to explain that argument as well in the briefing to this court.
If we were to agree with you about Larson, is there any reason to consider your equal protection claim, or are those two claims essentially redundant?
I think if you agree with us about Larson, there would not be any need to reach our equal protection claim. I think that's fair.
Let me ask about the, I'll call this religious discrimination claim, to reach both the equal protection and establishment clause claims. And I'm not entirely persuaded by the argument, if only because the seven countries encompass only a relatively small percentage of Muslims. Do you have any information as to what percentage or what proportion of the adherents to Islam worldwide are citizens or residents of those countries? My quick penciling suggests it's something less than 15%.
I don't know if I'm not sure, but to be clear,
given that all those countries are countries that have been previously tagged as subjects of concern about terrorism, granted it's because of perhaps radical Islam sects, so there might be a religious motivation behind the terrorism. But I have trouble understanding why we're supposed to infer religious animus when, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims would not be affected as residents of those nations, and where the concern for terrorism with those connected with radical Islamic sects is kind of hard to deny.
You know, the case law from this court and the Supreme Court is very clear that to prove religious discrimination, we do not need to prove that this murder harms only Muslims or that it harms every Muslim. We just need to prove that it was motivated in part by a desire to harm Muslims. And we have alleged that.
How do you infer that desire if, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims are unaffected?
We are, in part, you can infer it from intent evidence. I mean, there are statements that we've quoted in our complaint that are rather shocking evidence of intent to discriminate against Muslims, given that we haven't even had any discovery yet to find out what else we've been said in private. I mean, the public statements from the president and his top advisors reflecting that intent are strong evidence, and certainly at this pleading stage, to allow us to go forward on that claim. And again, you know, with no type of discrimination claim requires you to show that every single person of that category was harmed by the action. You just have to show that the action was motivated in part by a desire to harm that group. And that's exactly what
a situation where the proportion affected were less than 15%.
Your Honor, I haven't thought about it.
The other part of it. Do you deny that, in fact, there is concern about people coming from those countries, separate and apart from what their religion might be, because as Congress and the previous administration have concluded, those countries are a concern from a terrorist perspective? By the previous administration and by Congress is religiously motivated?
No.
It would be possible to identify these countries as a source of concern and possibly as the subject of special treatment without having religious motivation or discriminatory intent behind it.
Well, Your Honor, cases like McCreary from the U.S. Supreme Court make very clear that in assessing establishment clause claims, an action that could have been perfectly legitimate if done with proper intent is not legitimate and is unconstitutional if done with a desire to favor one religion over another. McCreary makes that very clear. It literally says the exact same action could be acceptable if done for some reasons and not acceptable if done for others. And here we've alleged very plausibly, with great detail, that this was done to favor one religious group or another. And so we should be allowed to go forward on that claim, even though, yes, we're not denying that these countries could have theoretically, and in fact were previously chosen for some lesser level.
It's not just an allegation at this stage. You've got to demonstrate a likelihood of success. So what is it that should lead us to conclude that you've got a likelihood of success if we even prove the religious animus you allege?
Well, Your Honor, for starters, that the president called for a complete ban on the entry of Muslims, and then...
Is this that bad?
No, we're not saying that this is a complete ban on Muslims entering the country. Obviously, I mean, they realize that, I mean, this is what his advisor said on television was that he was asked for a way to implement a narrower thing that would be legal. But the point is that was clearly unmotivating what we have alleged. And again, yes, it is, we do have to show a likelihood of success, but at this stage, the case law is clear. Our plausible allegations are taken as true for assessing that likelihood of success.
That cannot possibly be true. We are supposed to take your word for it, the fact that you make an allegation of the complaint, and that equals likelihood of success. You don't really mean that, do you?
Well, Your Honor, what I mean is that
do I have to believe everything you allege and say, well, that must be right? That's not the standard.
You've actually supported these allegations with exhibits, haven't you?
We have found many of our allegations with Exhibit F, Judge Friedland. We have, and I think that that's important. We've presented an enormous amount of evidence, especially considering, again, that we are a time between our filing, our complaint was filed a week ago Monday, together with the temporary restraining order motion, together with the declaration. So all these cases, we had extraordinarily little opportunity to actually gather and present evidence.
You filed to the government for exactly the same thing. Don't tell us you need more time because the government brought the stay motion. Well, don't tell us you need more time. You're the one that sought the temporary restraining order. Either you have the evidence presented in the record or you don't. I mean, don't tell us maybe you'll gather it later. If you can't demonstrate a likelihood of success with what you've got in the record so far, and maybe you can. I'm not saying you can't. But so far, I haven't heard a lot of reference to evidence. And a lot more references to allegations, and I don't think allegations got it at this stage.
This is if the motion before us is a motion for stay, who has the burden of showing likelihood of success?
Who have to show that they are likely to succeed on appeal. We have the burden of the district court of showing likelihood of success on the merits. But the state standard is very clear that it's the party seeking a stay that has to show a likelihood of success on appeal. And again, we believe that it would be more appropriate to treat this as a mandamus action where they would have to show a clear and indisputable right to relief. And in part, we think that because if you don't, then it's the district court's temporary restraining order that the federal government is going to maintain is the order to be appealed from ultimately. And that's just not proper, given that in either form or substance or intent was that meant to be a preliminary injunction order. It was meant to be a temporary restraining order. The district court was very clear about that. And the district court should have an opportunity to consider the preliminary injunction briefing and issue a preliminary injunction order that could then be reviewed.
Is there more evidence that is necessary, though? I mean, I think most of your claims are going to get de novo review anyway, so I don't know if we really need to wait for the district court to do more unless more evidence is going to be presented.
We do intend to file some additional declarations and evidence in the district court if given that opportunity. But I think it's also important to note this for fairness, to think of fairness to the district court itself. The district court should have an opportunity to consider something that it actually thinks is a preliminary injunction order so that they can assess the evidence and have more time to issue an order that's framed as an intended preliminary injunction order that this court could review. And if I just ask that if you said not to do that, if you decide to treat this as a preliminary injunction ruling in a state motion, then I ask you to issue an opinion that treats it like a preliminary injunction ruling and that gives it the sort of consideration that you would want that reviewed with, because the other side, the federal government has already made very clear that they intend to seek immediate review if this court denies the stay. And, of course, you know, it would be unfair to this court and to the district court to have the federal government take to the U.S. Supreme Court in an order that was explicitly framed as a temporary restraining order and that the judge understandably issued.
So if you were to issue a reasoned opinion, would that take care of this concern, or is there a concern beyond that?
I think that would address much of the concern, Your Honor. I would ask that you do either one or the other. I mean, I do think it would be better procedurally and more in keeping with the court's precedent to send the case back to the district court to find this temporary restraining order to allow us to put in the evidence that we wish to support the preliminary injunction motion and to allow the district court to issue a preliminary injunction ruling. But if you're not going to do that, then I do think a reasoned opinion would do much to address that concern.
Can you tell us whether your further evidence would be more about standing or more about the merits or both?
I think it would be primarily just slightly more detail about standing at this point. I mean, of course, the difficulty with a claim that's about intent is that we've made these allegations. We haven't had any discovery yet, and realistically, you know, we'll take some time to gather that sort of evidence beyond public statements, and this court has held, and so has the U.S. Supreme Court, that when a case has to do with intent, you know, it's remarkable to have this much evidence of intent without any discovery. I think it's probably the best way to characterize it. So I think that the court should keep that in mind in assessing likelihood of success.
We've taken you down to 4 minutes. Is there anything you'd like to conclude with?
determination.
precedent. Where that determination and the four corners of that determination are explicitly based on the congressional determination that the countries at issue are of concern and does not go beyond that.
You're using Dinh and Mandel as your main authority for the unreviewability. And so now you're saying those are distinguishable. I'm a little confused whether you're relying on those cases or not.
We are definitely relying on them for the limits that courts review these types of issues. I'm adding that when you have the document itself, and that's the best evidence of the intent of the president, it relies exclusively on the calls made by Congress and the administration in 2016 about the safety concerns presented by the specific countries at issue, that is the end of the inquiry and should be. In fact, the other side cited this court's recent Cardenas decision, and there, in describing the state of the law, the court very clearly said that Congress could have enacted a blanket prohibition on communist aliens, and that is, in here we have the president making a categorical determination based on the identification of countries of concern. And there's nothing strange.
You answered the question that was asked earlier about what if the order said Netflix. And you've been analogizing to cases that were about people who were communists who advocated overthrow of the U.S. government. And are you saying that the external evidence here that is alleged that the intent here was to ban Muslims is equivalent to that?
If there were an executive order that prevented the entry of Muslims, then there would be people withstanding the challenge that, and I think that would raise Establishment Clause, First Amendment issues. But that's not the order we have here. This order is limited to the countries defined by Congress. And
that was the motivation, and plaintiffs have submitted evidence that they suggest shows that was the motivation. So why shouldn't the case proceed, perhaps to discovery, to see if that really was the motivation or not?
We're not saying the case shouldn't proceed, but it is extraordinary for a court to enjoin the president's national security determination based on some newspaper articles, and that's what has happened here. That is not a very troubling second guessing of the national security decision made by the president. And the notion that we are going to go back and report him.
Stop. This is Judge Clay. Don't you deny that, in fact, the statements attributed to then candidate Trump and to his political advisors, and most recently Mr. Giuliani, do you deny that those statements were made?
Judge Clay, no. I would note that Judge Robart himself said that. He wasn't going to look at campaign statements.
That's a different point. I understand the argument they shouldn't be given much weight, but when you say we shouldn't be looking at newspaper articles, we're all on a fast track here. Both sides have told us it's moving too fast. Either those kind of statements were made or they're not. Now, if they were made, but they were made not to be a serious policy principle, I can understand that. But if they were made, it is potential evidence. It is a basis for an argument. So I just want to make sure I know what's on the table.
Well, they're in the record, but I think my point is a little narrower, that in the expedited procedure of a TRO, taking this extraordinary action of halting this order that the president determined was in the national security interest of the United States is an unwise course and it should be stayed.
If you thought there was a problem that this is too preliminary, if we let this go forward to a preliminary injunction hearing, do you have evidence that you would present?
I think we definitely would like the opportunity to present evidence that back in the district court, and we also think that the scope of this law is really needs to be.
Can you tell us anything about the type of evidence you would present so that we can consider that whether further proceedings are needed?
Not yet, but I do. Another point is the scope of the suit statute and the injunction would really need to be narrowed as the parties focus in on the actual harms. The harms that Washington has cited focus on residents of Washington, but the order goes way beyond that to the areas of the most concern of the president, people who have never been to this country yet and have no connection to Washington, no connection to the United States, and no claim of constitutional rights, either on their own or through Washington.
If I can ask my colleagues to indulge me for a moment, that does raise a serious concern on my part. And the scope of the order, most obviously having to do with the lawful permanent residents, which the government's position now is they're not included from the scope of the order. I have to say, is there any legal authority for the counsel of the president to have power to instruct the other departments or to instruct us as to what the order means? I mean, the president can amend the order, but I'm not sure that the counsel of the president has that authority. So why is it we should be looking at this reconceived order, and why is it we should, rather than try to narrowly carve out the injunction you're asking for, because of practical problems, I don't know how I'd write such an order. Why shouldn't we look to the executive branch to more clearly define what the order means, rather than have to look through the lens of these subsequent interpretations?
Let me make 2 points there. One, the guidance from the White House counsel is the definitive interpretation of the order, and the White House counsel speaks for the president in this context. Second, in our reply brief, at the very end on page 11, we had our kind of suggestion for the kind of order that would actually address the harms identified by Washington. And there, I'm going to read that. At most, the injunction should be limited to the class of individuals on whom the state's claims rest, previously admitted aliens who are temporarily abroad now or who wish to travel and return to the United States in the future. That is the core of the harm they've identified. When we're talking about an injunction entered on such a preliminary basis, it should be limited to the claims that the state is making and not issued more broadly. If there are no further questions, I encourage the court to stay the injunction or to limit it to the presentation of the state of Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. This matter is submitted. We appreciate the importance and the time-sensitive nature of this matter and will endeavor to issue our decision as soon as possible. Thank you again for appearing on such short notice. We are adjourned.
This court for this session stands adjourned.